Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to the great listeners who support this program. We get a grant from the Hearst Foundation. Actually, it's a monthly contribution from Gillian G. Hearst. Thank you, Gillian. Also, Susan Fellows, Teresa Paris, and my pal Joe Kells. If you'd like to help, and you can, go to my website at peterbcollins.com. The link's on the right-hand side of the homepage. Set you up with a PayPal voluntary subscription starting at just $5 a month. Straight ahead, we'll be joined by an outspoken and courageous man committed to military justice, Colonel Morris Davis, who served as the lead prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has some powerful comments, including that a certain president named Obama lost his testicles. You'll hear that in just a few minutes. But in a related topic, you will hear Colonel Morris Davis talk about how the Senate and the House blocked the president from closing Guantanamo by banning the transfer of prisoners to the United States. And Colonel Davis points out that there are other ways, other government departments, who could achieve the same goal. And the United States Senate is busy shutting one of those doors. And this got very little attention, and that's why I wanted to lead this podcast with it. Because in mid-October, on about the 22nd of October, at 1 o'clock in the morning, as the Senate was trying to wrap up business and get back to fundraising, they took up a measure to strip the Department of Justice of the power to charge and try any non-American terrorism suspect captured anywhere in the world. The measure was carried by Kelly Ayotte, a New Hampshire Republican and a fresh woman who is a favorite of the far right in this country. 42 senators voted for the measure. It didn't pass. But it gives you a sense of the forces at work and the lack of any progressive people to stand up and fight against these kinds of efforts in the Senate. And there's a bill pending that is attached to the annual military budget, written by Carl Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, and it's not much better. And I need to ask you to pay attention to these issues, because the New York Times and other publications do cover the work of the Senate, but they often fail to properly emphasize the danger of some of these actions. And the Levin amendment allows, in theory, for a prisoner to be tried later in a civil court, but under conditions that make it almost impossible. And as the New York Times stated in an editorial on October 23rd, the Levin amendment would cripple the FBI investigations of terrorism suspects. It would make Guantanamo nearly permanent, because the legislation basically doesn't allow you to send these prisoners anywhere else, or suspects, as they often are. There is no provision for judicial review of the decision to send a prisoner to military detention. And as we will discuss with Colonel Morris Davis here in just a minute, there are some people, more than 40, who are expected to be held indefinitely and never, ever tried, which is a judicial black hole that is unimaginable and extremely un-American. And the Times goes on to note that the 11th Amendment is unnecessary because civil courts have tried many terrorists and sentenced them and imprisoned them. And where's the president? Will the president veto a 11th Amendment or an Ayotte Amendment? Maybe if he finds those testicles that went missing, according to Colonel Davis. The myth of American exceptionalism tells us that we are the beacon of liberty, an exporter of freedom. And all of that is belied by one word, one place, one set of ugly policies, barbaric at that. And the word is Guantanamo. Colonel Morris Davis joins us here on the Peter B. Collins Show today. He has a long and deep history in military justice. He volunteered to serve on the legal teams at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, way back in 2002. And he initially thought he would be representing people as a defense counsel, but he was named as chief prosecutor at Guantanamo, resigning in October 2007. And he will explain why he resigned and why he started an organization called Crimes of War. You can visit their website at crimesofwar.org. Colonel Davis, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And first, this is not something rote or just reactionary, but I thank you for your service. And I thank you for honoring the oath that you took when you joined the military and the ethical standards that you embraced when you got your law degree.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think a lot of people don't realize that the oath you take is to the Constitution, not to the president or any particular person. And there are a lot of good folks in the military, so I'm happy to be able to stand up and speak for many of them.
Well, and Colonel, just a quick side note, it's important to state that the loss of our constitutional rights in this country, we're not caused by an enemy. We're not caused by an outsider. It is our own political leaders who dismantled parts of the constitutional system that I value so greatly.
I agree with you entirely. It's unfortunately, for the last decade, we've let fear override, principles and ideals that we've held for, for two centuries. And hopefully at some point the country will regain its senses and we'll get back on the right footing.
Now, I don't know about you, but on the day after his inauguration, when President Obama, with media attention and a flourish, signed his executive order to close Guantanamo, I had very mixed emotions because it's very much what I wanted to occur. But I thought back to Bill Clinton's initiative on his first full day in the Oval Office, when he lifted the ban on gays serving in the military, and it led to a 19-year debacle called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And at least in these two cases, I see a cautionary note about presidents who make sweeping commitments on the first or second day they serve in the office.
Well, certainly the track record hadn't been good. To be honest, I guess, as an indication of my lack of clairvoyance, had you asked me in January 2009 which policy President Obama would succeed in repealing, the Guantanamo detention policy or the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, I would have made the wrong choice.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. Now, I want to credit my friend and colleague Jason Leopold, the deputy managing editor and investigative reporter at truthout.org. I'm going to link to the interview that he published on Sunday, November 13th at Truth Out. And I just am really pleased that you, as one individual, Colonel, are willing to stand firm for fundamentals of American democracy, the rule of law, the adherence to treaties that we are party to, and the firm observance of constitutional rights of all parties. And yet we see a kind of pandering that starts at the political level and is aided and abetted by the corporate media in this country, because nobody really bothers to report the embarrassment that President Obama has suffered over the pushback from military leaders and political leaders against his desire to close Guantanamo. And he's moved on now, like, well, you know, I swatted that fly and it's dead, and we don't want to talk about it anymore. But we're now 10 years into this barbaric episode, and the games that we continue to play, for example, expecting that the rest of the world believes the canard that because Guantanamo is offshore, that U.S. laws don't apply. And so it's like being in orbit somewhere, that it's all so convenient that we can claim that we bring people to justice. We just ask people not to examine the process because it wouldn't live up to close scrutiny.
Right. Yeah. You know, one of the kind of a running joke at Guantanamo was you've got to lose to win. Because if you look at it, there have been six military commissions where people have been convicted of war crimes. And two of those six, you know, David Hicks and Salim Hamdan are free men back in their home countries. And then you've got 172 people that are still at Guantanamo, many that the administration has no intention of prosecuting or releasing, that are there indefinitely. So if you can actually get charged with a war crime and convicted, you have some prospect of actually going home. So, you know, like I said, you know, our joke was you had to lose to win.
Now, when the Congress passed the Military Commissions Act in 2006, I dubbed it the Joe Stalin Detention and Kangaroo Court Act of 2006. And it is amazing to me that the current president opposed that, said that he was going to fix it when he was elected, and yet he then reversed himself. And in a speech that really is one of the most dubious of his presidency, he went to the National Archive and stood in front of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution in order to announce that he wasn't going to follow the Constitution when it came to the military commissions and the disposal of the cases at Guantanamo.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. The candidate, if we had candidate Obama in office, because he was very eloquent and right on point when he was a senator and when he was a candidate for office. And, you know, as I noted in the article that Jason published, something happened between the steps of the Capitol and the White House on Inauguration Day, because his willingness to stand up and do the right thing seemed to evaporate. I mean, you can almost, you know, look at George Bush and say, well, you know, he didn't know any better. You know, Barack Obama knows better. He just doesn't have the backbone to follow through and do what the right thing is to do.
Well, I agree more with the latter than the former, but Bush is no longer in office, and unless an international court or a court in another nation comes after him, that's pretty much a moot issue. But
although, you know, it's been interesting, Peter, just in the last, you watched the Republican debate Saturday night. You had John Huntsman and Ron Paul, who both said waterboarding is torture.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the last 48 hours, you've had John McCain tweeting, saying waterboarding is torture. And you had President Obama at his meeting out in Hawaii saying waterboarding is torture. So there seems to be a fairly broad agreement, a, you know, bipartisan agreement, that waterboarding was torture, that we tortured people. And under the Convention Against Torture, there's an affirmative duty to investigate and prosecute allegations of torture. So we've got leaders, you know, from the House of Representatives to the White House that have said we tortured, and we're doing absolutely nothing about it. So
we are
hypocritical to behave that way.
Indeed. And I did see parts of the Republican debate on CBS. I give CBS credit for having a little more gravitas than some of these wrestling matches that the Republicans have been participating in. And I do agree that Huntsman and Paul both showed great courage in taking on the pandering of the other candidates, including Rick Perry, who wasn't he didn't have a memory problem when it came to waterboarding. He flatly thinks it's only enhanced interrogation. And Colonel Morris, let's get beyond the bullshit here, because it's not limited to waterboarding. The
right.
tactics that were used that are called enhanced interrogation, or apologists call them soft torture, they clearly violated international law, the Geneva Conventions, and our own legal bans on torture. And to focus only on waterboarding, as if it were the only thing that even approached or crossed the line, is really insulting.
Right. Yeah, I think it's, you know, for the public, I think waterboarding is certainly a clear example. But you're right. There were many other things. I mean, there are only, you know, as you know, there are three people that were waterboarded. So it's a fairly small group. But there are a lot of other things that I would hope, if it was being done to Americans, we would object to strenuously. We did to people, and we just pretend like nothing happened. You know, President Obama said he wants to look forward and not look back. But yet, you know, we expect others around the world to live up to an example that we don't set ourselves, and to have a higher standard of accountability than we do for ourselves.
Now, Colonel, you're the juris doctor here. In my simplistic layperson's view, when the president says he wants to look forward, not backward, and his Justice Department has a de facto policy of not even investigating criminal referrals of serious wrongdoing, not marginal behavior where somebody just bent the rules a little bit, but serious wrongdoing, he's turning a blind eye to it. And I don't believe that it's optional, that we have a choice of saying, well, you know, it's just not a good time to investigate. The public won't react. It's too embarrassing. I mean, there are all kinds of excuses you can offer, but there is no excuse for saying that we're just not going to delve into these issues because it's not politically convenient for President Obama.
Oh, you're preaching to the choir on that one. I agree with you 100%. If you look at the Convention Against Torture or our domestic torture statute that was passed back in the 90s with broad bipartisan support, it doesn't say, hey, when it's convenient, or if it's not going to interfere with your reelection campaign, or when you get around to it. It's an affirmative duty to investigate and prosecute allegations of torture, and there are no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And if we're not going to live up to our obligation, then we ought to have the integrity to repudiate the convention and not pretend we're a party.
And does it amount to obstruction of justice for the president to articulate this and for all of the Justice Department lawyers to follow it?
Well, I would say it's at least a dereliction of duty. You know, in the military, you have legal duties that you're required to fulfill, and if you don't do it, then you're derelict in performing your duties. And under the convention and under the domestic statute, it's not optional. It's a duty. So I would say there's certainly a dereliction of duty on the part of the administration.
Mm-hmm. Now, you used some strong language with Jason Leopold in the Truth Out interview, and let me quote, "There's a pair of testicles somewhere between the Capitol building and the White House that fell off the president after Election Day." And I certainly agree with you that this was a lack of testicular fortitude or balls on the president's part. And yet, I developed the term Leflon, Colonel. You may recall that Ronald Reagan was called the Teflon president by Congresswoman Pat Schroeder. And I believe that Obama went to DuPont and got the new and improved Leflon, so that nothing that comes from his political left sticks to him. And this is one of those issues where people thought, it was a good idea, but the way the public has reacted, the way the thought of conducting the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York City was rebuffed by people from Bloomberg on down to Democratic members of the United States Senate. So where do you believe he lost his way or lost his courage? And do you think that this is something that can be recovered?
Well, I think he came into office with, as I said, I think to this day in his heart of hearts, he knows the right answer. He knows what we need to do. I believe he came into office intending to close Guantanamo and to do away with the military commissions. My view is, he came into office as the economy was falling off a cliff and health care reform was top of his agenda. And this just wasn't a top five issue for him, that he was willing to go to the mat with Congress. I mean, when he came into office, he had a majority in the House and the Senate. If you can't get it done then, you're never going to get it done. So I think had he been insistent on fulfilling his promise, then it could have been done. I'll give you an example. You know, initially Congress banned him from using any money in the defense appropriation to bring anyone from Guantanamo or to move anyone out of Guantanamo. There are other federal agencies that have airplanes or access to airplanes. So if he wanted, you know, if there was a will for it to be done, it would have been done. He just didn't have the will.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that this is reversible in a second Obama term? Would he find the courage? It doesn't look like he'd have the political support just based on how it appears the election will take shape next year now.
Well, I hate to say never. I mean, as you mentioned, it's been a decade that we've been at this, and you know, I keep hoping at some point we're going to get back to our core values and our ideals and do the right thing. So I don't think it excuses having turned a blind eye to it for the past 3 years, but you know, I'm hopeful when there's not another election on the horizon that maybe he'll have the backbone to follow through.
But, Colonel, if you see this as part of a larger picture, this is the president who said that he would end the Bush wiretapping. And then in the summer of 2008, he voted for the FISA reforms and hasn't revisited that issue in any way, shape, or form. He singularly blocked the efforts by Binyan Muhammad and four other former detainees to sue for their rights and to try to recover some apology or damages for the treatment that they endured. Then the Obama administration put heavy pressure on the British government not to let Binyan Muhammad or other former prisoners at Guantanamo find a day in court in Britain, and that was only partly successful. And WikiLeaks has exposed the efforts of the president to maintain, if not extend, many of the same troublesome policies that started under George W. Bush. So when you see this as part of the bigger picture, it's hard to isolate Guantanamo and say, oh, he meant well, he just couldn't quite pull it off.
No, I agree. I mean, in many respects, this has been the continuation of a third Bush term, because it appears he's not only embraced the Bush policies, but embraced them and ran with them. You know, to me, I think one of the most egregious examples, and one that I think the country ought to be particularly upset about, is Maria Arar, you know, the Canadian citizen who, you know, wound up in Syria, you know, a country that we've got on the list of state sponsors of terror.
Right.
And we send someone there to be tortured. When we figure out it's the wrong guy, we, you know, send him home. The Canadian government, I believe, paid him $10 million for their part.
That's right.
And then we use the state secrets privilege to deny him the opportunity to go to court. We won't even apologize for our behavior. So, I mean, if we're the beacon of the rule of law, then the rule of law is in real trouble.
Right. And Maher Arar surfaced in Germany at the time that Condoleezza Rice was on what I called her Torturepalooza tour, where she was going around denying that we tortured. And here this guy pops up. There was somebody at almost every stop as she toured Europe saying, oh, no, we don't torture, and we haven't violated your airspace with our torture taxis by flying people through without permission. Those are lies. Those are flat-out lies.
Well, and I think people recognize that. You know, recently the Canadian government, the U.S. had asked to extradite one of the Cotter brothers back from Canada to the U.S. to stand trial. And the Canadian government has refused to extradite him because they can't guarantee he won't be tortured in the United States. So, you know, even our friends recognize who we are, even if we won't admit it.
Now, you referenced Omer Khadr, actually his brother there, and I was going to bring that up a little bit later. In a sidebar to the Truth Out piece, Jason Leopold noted some of your inconsistencies over the years, and one of them relates to the case of Omer Khadr. This was the young man. He was a teenager at the time he was picked up. He was severely injured in the firefight in Afghanistan, and he was there with his father. We know that. The father was a jihadist, and the kid was just with his dad. And in a film, a documentary that a group of Canadians recently released, it's gripping to see Omer Khadr interrogated by Canadian officers. But the film kind of buries the most important piece, which is it very strongly suggests that Omer Khadr could not have thrown the hand grenade that killed the American soldier as accused because he was injured before the that event occurred. Do you have a current opinion on the Khadr case and whether he might actually be innocent of what he was charged with?
Yeah, the Khadr case is one that, before I resigned in 2007, there were three cases that I personally authorized the charges on. David Hicks, Salim Hamdan, and Omer Khadr. Your description, the Khadr family, as you said, his father was an associate of Osama bin Laden for a great many years, and had taken the family from Canada back to Afghanistan. Now, at the time, Omar was not with his father. His father was killed later in a firefight with, I believe, the Pakistani authorities.
Mm-hmm.
But Omar was with a group of men that, he was the only survivor after a lengthy firefight. Whether he threw the grenade or not, I don't know. I believe that he did.
Okay.
Because he was shot after the grenade was thrown. He was behind a wall. He was shot afterwards. And if you've seen the pictures of him, it's I think a testament to our troops that after going through this firefight, that they tended to his wounds, what I think to any reasonable person looked like fatal wounds. But with Omer Khadr, to me, it became a question of not could we prosecute him. It was a question of should we.
Mm-hmm.
We're the only country in modern history to prosecute someone for war crimes who was a 15-year-old foot soldier. And is that the example that America wants to set, that 15-year-olds are being prosecuted as war criminals?
And it also points up another of a number of other anomalies, such as that these were not uniformed soldiers fighting American troops. It's really unknown to me the extent to which Omer Khadr was actively involved. It appears his dad had just left him with these other people at this scene where the firefight developed. And beyond that, it just strikes me that we try to create a situation that because he is accused of killing an American soldier, that is an extraordinary act. And in a war context, it doesn't seem extraordinary to me, Colonel.
No, it's clearly tragic and unfortunate, but it's an incident of war. You go to war, some people are wounded and some are killed, and it's unfortunate, but you're right. Does that equate then into a war crime?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, when the accused is 15 years old.
Right. And it really seemed to be, because it occurred so early in the conflict in Afghanistan, it seemed to be a kind of vengeance, not justice.
You're probably right. And there's certainly, at least from what I saw, there was no great effort by the Canadian government to liberate Omer Khadr. You had the British government and a number of other allies that asked for their citizens back and by and large got them back. I think because of Omer Khadr's family history and, his family was known as the first family of terrorism in Canada, I don't think there was any great impetus by the Canadian government to liberate him and bring him home. And so he spent his teen years and into his early adult years at Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Colonel Morris Davis here on the Peter B. Collins Show, the former lead prosecutor for the United States military at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Let me read a quote from the Jason Leopold article, Colonel. This is a quote from candidate Barack Obama in August of 2007, speaking at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Quote, "I will reject a legal framework that does not work. I have faith in America's courts, and I have faith in our judge advocate generals. As president, I will close Guantanamo, reject the Military Commissions Act, and adhere to the Geneva Conventions. Our Constitution and our Uniform Code of Military Justice provide a framework for dealing with the terrorists. Our Constitution works. We will again set an example for the world. that the law is not subject to the whims of stubborn rulers, and that justice is not arbitrary. Wow.
That sure sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah. It hurts. It hurts to read these words and to compare them to the reality almost 3 years into this man's presidency.
It is. I mean, it's disappointing. I mean, I wish I had a better term to describe it, but as I said, I mean, clearly he knows better. I mean, he said all the right words in what the passage you just read and has not followed through on doing it, and the country continues down this path of avoiding the law.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our strength has always been the law, and for the last decade, we've done our best to avoid it when it's inconvenient. And
mm-hmm.
that's not the way the law is supposed to be. It's supposed to apply in good times and bad. And it's disappointing that he hadn't lived up to the high ideals that he set as a candidate.
Colonel Andy Worthington, the British journalist who has done a job that other journalists should attempt to live up to, he has covered the issues of Guantanamo, the cases of each individual in great detail, and I have a just incredible respect for Andy and the dedication that he has shown to this important story, despite the lack of interest by most media around the world. And what Andy's data show is that about 775 or so individuals were held at Guantanamo starting in 2002, that more than 600 of those have been released without charge. And while we go to great lengths to say that doesn't mean they are completely innocent, the fact that, you know, we held them for so long and couldn't find anything to charge them with shows the emptiness of the statements from Rumsfeld, Cheney, and others that only the worst of the worst went to Guantanamo. We know that when we paid bounties for individuals early in the engagement in Afghanistan, that many purely innocent people were sold into our custody and took years for them to get out of Guantanamo. So we now have a much smaller population there. Let me start with the most troublesome population, which is the individuals who are slated to never be tried and never be released. And I believe that there are 40 to 50 people who fall into that category. And this was the new category that was created in the president's speech at the National Archive.
Right. Yeah, I think of there are basically three categories of detainees. You've got the group you mentioned that the administration doesn't intend to prosecute or release. There's the group of, you know, the military commission cases, the Khalid Sheikh Mohammeds and the al-Nashiris that the administration intends to prosecute. And then a third group of people that have been cleared for release or transfer that the only reason they're incarcerated is because of their citizenship, primarily Yemenis,
mm-hmm.
that you know, their only crime is their citizenship. But you're right. The really problematic group is that group that is kind of in that netherland of not facing trial and not facing charges and not facing any prospect of going home anytime soon. Because certainly if you buy the concept that the war on terror is a war, it's not going to end in our lifetime. So what process are they entitled to? There's an excellent movie I would recommend called The Response by Sig Leibowitz. Is actually based on the transcripts from the combatant status review tribunals conducted at Guantanamo that I think really give people an inside look at the frustration and the Alice in Wonderland-like environment that it is. But to be perfectly honest, I think the vast majority of the American public doesn't care. I mean, they bought into the worst of the worst in this, you know, you're either with us or you're with the terrorist argument. And I think the vast majority is kind of out of sight and out of mind. And there's more concern about the tragic end to Kim Kardashian's 72-day marriage than there is about the 172 men held for 10 years at Guantanamo.
Yeah, and I don't give a hoot about Kim Kardashian and her marriage. She appears to be a hypocrite, and she can live with that. But the hypocrisy of American policy, as we continue to hold these individuals— and claim that we're bringing Osama bin Laden to justice and we're bringing Anwar al-Awlaki to justice, and we deplore the Iranian and Syrian regimes. We help to take out Gaddafi. All of these often based on fundamental human rights. And yet we claim that because we're in a war on terror that will be endless, that we can hold these individuals without charge and without any prospect of release, just disappear them forever?
That's the theory. And again, I think if it was an American citizen, I mean, you saw the effort that we made to get the hikers back from Iran. There's an American being detained in Cuba,
yeah,
who brought in radio equipment there that the Cuban government's holding. And we've worked hard to get our citizens back out of detention in other countries. While we maintain this indefinite detention at Guantanamo, I mean, it's one of those things where we condemn it when other people do it and condone it when we do it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if that's the leader of the free world, then we're in trouble.
Yeah. Now, I'd like to know the extent to which you're aware of those who have been released from Guantanamo, but for various reasons cannot be repatriated to their home nation. And I believe there's some 60 who, including the Uyghurs, who are best known. Some went to islands in the Pacific. Some went to Bermuda. But I'm in touch with two former inmates at Guantanamo who were resettled to European nations. And this is done under the auspices, and it's highly secret, of a special envoy at the State Department named Daniel Freed. And one of the former prisoners who I've been talking with has serious health problems. The terms of the agreement to resettle him with his wife and children have not been met 2 years after he's been sent to a country where he doesn't speak the language, doesn't have a job, and is essentially a prisoner of a different kind in a completely foreign land. And so he's happy to be out of Guantanamo, but the State Department and his minders in the host country basically have just taken to ignoring him. And the message imputed is, you should just be glad that you're no longer at Guantanamo. How much can you tell us about these resettlement plans to other countries?
Really not much. I mean, during my two-year tenure as chief prosecutor, we had a fairly narrow focus on the cases that we were trying to bring to trial. So out of the 775 men that were either were at Guantanamo, there were about 75 that were kind of on our scope. So the other roughly 700 we really had no involvement with, and it was a separate process. So I really don't know that much about the resettlement program, mm-hmm, other than, we're hypocritical. Take the Uyghurs, for instance. There were dozens of countries that for years we lobbied to help us out and take some of these guys as they weren't a threat. And then you had a federal judge that ordered them released here in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And suddenly, the far right went nuts and said, these guys are dangerous and we can't have them in the U.S. So we want other people to help us out, but we're not going to do anything to participate in that process. So, again, I think it makes us look extraordinarily hypocritical to expect others to help us, and we won't help ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Colonel, Jason Leopold recounted in this article one of the most bizarre conversations that I've heard about, and it must have struck you as just so damn weird. But here you were appointed as the chief prosecutor at Guantanamo for the military commissions, and you encounter Jim Haines, William Haines, who was the general counsel under Rumsfeld at the Pentagon. He now works for Chevron, trying to protect their profits from the Ecuadorian government over the massive mess that they inherited when Chevron took over Texaco. But you had this conversation with Haines where you referenced the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals. And you said, Jim, at Nuremberg, not everyone was acquitted. There were some acquittals. Why don't you take it from there? How did Haines respond?
Well, it was like the thought had never occurred to him that anyone could possibly be found not guilty at a military commission. His eyes got big. He leaned back in his chair and he said, acquittals? We can't have acquittals. We've been holding these guys for years. How are we going to explain to the world holding these guys if they're acquitted? We've got to have convictions. We can't have acquittals. I just think it had never occurred to him. I think a lot of folks like Jim Haynes and David Addington and John Yoo and Alberto Gonzalez and the other civilian political appointees that, you know, were the big brains of this operation, they thought the military was just going to, you know, salute and make this easy, and it was going to be fast and secret, and it would all be done. And I think they were shocked that folks in uniform didn't behave the way they expected. You know, like you had Charlie Swift took the Hamdan case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court when they brought him in to negotiate a guilty plea.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for the civilian political appointees, it was for them a rude awakening that military law and military lawyers doesn't march to their tune.
But doesn't this also expose that the commissions, the tribunals, are political theater? With you write, for example, about how the rules change faster than who shot Bob, and that in the Cotter case, they announced the trial rules just minutes before the case was convened. And that in this upcoming trial, they've given 48 hours notice of what the tribunal rules will be. But isn't this just, you know, it's a show trial. It's not a real trial. And you got a real surprise there when you thought you were involved in something that was real.
Yeah, I mean, the example I used is kind of like, you know, around here we have these community playhouses that put on a mystery dinner theater. Guantanamo is like the mystery dinner theater minus the mystery and the meal. Because, you know, when there's no doubt when the Sherry goes to trial, there's no doubt what the outcome's going to be. You know, the defense filed a motion and asked the government to acknowledge whether, if he was found not guilty, if he would get to go home. And they said no. So regardless of the outcome of the trial, they present the evidence and the jury finds him not guilty. He goes right back to the same cell he came out of that morning. So, you know, it's a head we win, tail you lose situation. That there's really, you know, you got the actors putting on their uniforms and going into court, and we've got theater in place of justice.
And when we look at this, why is there a 10-year delay? Now, not all the individuals have been there for 10 years, but if we're just going to convict some of these people and leave others to languish forever, why does it take so long? What kind of process is underway that makes this so slow and leaves these people dangling?
Well, you know, initially on November 13th, 2001, President Bush signed a military order that authorized detention and prosecution and military commission of unlawful, you know, enemy combatants. So though we just passed the decade mark on that, and we completed a total of 6 trials. It was based on, you had the big brains that were running this operation that looked back at World War II. There's a Supreme Court case called Ex Parte Curin. It was the 8 Nazi saboteurs that were captured and prosecuted in 1942. And in that case, it was 42 days from the time they were captured, prosecuted before a military commission, reviewed by the Supreme Court, executed and buried here in Washington by the Anacostia River. And that was the model that the Bush administration looked to. They pulled out President Roosevelt's old order and basically did a cut and paste. And they were shocked that, you know, if you could do it in 42 days in World War II, then, you know, why did these cases languish for as long as they did? Well, they didn't take account of that, you know, the law progressed considerably over the 5 or 6 decades since World War II. And, you know, as you know, the Hamdan case went all the way to the Supreme Court. It said that President Bush's military commissions were illegal and that it required congressional authorization.
Mm-hmm.
And long story short, I mean, it's been 10 years and we're still trying to grapple with a way to avoid the law. I mean, the reason that we're having to go to these extraordinary measures is the fact that we broke the law 10 years ago. And now we're having to try to create this extraordinary process to account for the 172 people at Guantanamo that we thought we'd take into a law-free zone and we could do whatever we wanted.
Well, and that virus seems to have spread because, Colonel, I'm very concerned about two aspects of the execution of Osama bin Laden. One, that there was no process. We didn't charge him or try him, even in one of these tribunals at Guantanamo, even in absentia. Then we killed him, and the American people just accept this as business as usual. And I really think that it cries out for process, and that even after the fact, we should build some sort of a case that proves our contention that he was the most evil man on the planet.
Well, yeah, I personally don't have as hard a time with Osama bin Laden as I do with Anwar al-Awlaki. An American citizen, if we wanted to take his house in foreclosure, you got to give him a judicial hearing. But the president can decide himself that he needs to die. And not only that, then we send a civilian agency. You know, you had the CIA, and I don't know if it was CIA employees or a contractor that fired the missile that killed an American citizen in Yemen. And I'm just not aware of any legal authority that classifies that as anything other than murder.
Well, I'm in full agreement with you on al-Awlaki. I think, though, that the precedent set in the bin Laden execution really gave the president the indications that there would be no real pushback, no penalty to him for moving down the food chain to an American citizen. And I agree that Osama bin Laden didn't enjoy constitutional rights. My issue is that if we really are going to change the dynamic with the Islamic world and with Islamic extremists, we need to separate ourselves from terrorism. And the way we do that is through the process of law. And by not even indicting bin Laden for the 9/11 events, and for never really pursuing him as a fugitive on those issues. You know, the FBI never put him on the most wanted list, and they conceded in the Moussaoui trial that they didn't have any evidence to directly connect him to 9/11. Now, I think he was involved in 9/11, but I'd like to see some proof of that so that we do stand as a nation of laws and not just arbitrary assassins.
Well, I don't disagree with your premise, but you know, you had an administration or two now that consider, like the Geneva Conventions. If you recall, during the Bush administration, they were referred to as quaint.
Right.
You know, for folks in uniform, the Geneva Conventions are in essence the Bible, and then we've got these civilian political appointees that said they're quaint and did everything they could to avoid. We came up with this whole new classification of unlawful enemy combatant. You won't find that term in the Geneva Conventions, and someone had to craft that term in order to avoid the Geneva Conventions. So, as you said, we've ignored the law, we've avoided the law, and we're a decade into this, and don't appear to be any closer to a solution than we did when it started.
And Colonel, I don't want to be too picky, but you just interjected the word alien into the phrase unlawful enemy combatant. And
right.
I don't believe that's in there, is it? I don't think the word alien is, because I'm led to believe that the Military Commissions Act of 2006 could be used against an American citizen residing inside the country.
Boy, I don't have it in front of me. My recollection is, if you look at it, that U.S. citizens are excluded from jurisdiction. So it only would apply to alien unlawful enemy combatant.
Okay. And then on what basis was al-Awlaki, an American citizen, put on the White House killer capture list?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the alarming part. I mean, it's. I think people, again, I don't think there's been a lot of public concern about executing al-Awlaki.
And what about his teenage sons? Two of his teenage sons were killed in subsequent drone strikes.
I agree, and there is no, again, as I said, I'm not aware of any legal authority. I mean, you can make the argument that had that been a U.S. military strike, that combatant immunity would apply. But these were strikes conducted by the CIA, which are civilian employees or civilian contractors that aren't eligible for combatant immunity under the law of war. So killing another human being, unless there's some legal justification like combatant immunity, is generally called murder. And I'm not aware of any legal justification that authorized, killing these people.
Well, and we still know very little about the mechanism. There appears to be a subset of the National Security Council that places names on a kill or capture list. And then it's very murky whether the president formally approves that or there's just this kind of wink and a nod. If the president doesn't approve, he takes that name off the list. But the criteria are not stated publicly. The participants are not disclosed. This is a completely untransparent cabal of people inside a nominally democratic government who make decisions about who to kill.
Well, as uncomfortable as that is now, what you just described, imagine when it's a Michelle Bachmann or a Rick Perry with their finger on the trigger, deciding, you know, which American needs to die.
Yeah, with Rick Perry, there'll be three of them, but he won't be able to remember the third.
Well, there is that possibility.
Yeah. Colonel, next I'd like to ask you a little bit about what this has cost you, because you resigned from the military, or at least you resigned your post at Guantanamo in 2007. Did you also resign or retire from the Air Force at that time?
Not at that time. It was shortly there. It was a year later, October 2008, is when I officially retired. But, I left the job. I resigned in October 4th of 2007.
And then you went to work for the Congressional Research Service, is that right?
Correct.
And
I started work there in December of 2008.
All right. And what happened there?
Well, it was interesting. Serving in the military is apolitical. You know, we take orders from the commander in chief. So for 25 years that I was in the military, I was prohibited, we don't participate in politics. And so I retired October 1st of 2008, and for the first time in my adult life, got to participate in the political process. I had an Obama sign in my front yard. I donated money to the campaign. I volunteered and went door to door. Somebody came in my yard, set my Obama sign on fire, and I put up another one. So I went to work at Congressional Research Service in December of 2008, and then Obama comes in January of 2009 and said he's going to close Guantanamo and close down the military commissions. That fall, when Attorney General Holder said they were backpedaling and they were considering some trials in federal court and some in military commissions, I wrote an op-ed that was published in the Wall Street Journal that said that was a legal double standard, and also published same day, November 2009, a letter to the editor in the Washington Post that took former Attorney General Mukasey to task for his fear-mongering over bringing detainees to the U.S. And, you know, in his view, it was going to be a cataclysmic result if that happened. And the day after my two opinion pieces were published, I received my notice that I was being terminated for having the audacity to express a public opinion. So I, you know, in addition to ending my military career over the military commissions, I also managed to end my civilian career under a Democratic administration as well. So I think I've hit that sweet spot where I'm a persona non grata on both sides of the aisle.
And now you're executive director of Crimes of War. This is described as an education project, and there's a website, crimesofwar.org. What's your mission there?
The project was actually started in the 1990s by a group of journalists that were covering the conflict in the Balkans. In fact, a couple of them, Roy Gutman, who was one of the founders, won the Pulitzer for his coverage of the war in Kosovo. But there were a group of journalists that saw what was happening in the Balkans, and it occurred to them that if people understood that war is not just unconstrained violence, that there are rules that apply and consequences for not following the rules, and perhaps some of the atrocities could be avoided. And they started this project to try to educate the public on the law of war. And so it's been going on for about 12 or 13 years now, and I've been with them since August of 2010. And as you said, our mission is an educational mission to try to educate the public worldwide on the Geneva Conventions and the laws of war.
Colonel, one thing I meant to ask a little earlier I wanted to touch on is in June of 2006, three inmates at Guantanamo were pulled out of the main camp and individually transported to a nearby so-called black site. And eyewitness accounts reported by Scott Horton, the law professor from Columbia who writes for Harper's Magazine, indicate that those three men came back dead. And it was then announced that they had committed suicide by stuffing rags down their throats, a very far-fetched story. That was backed up by the commander of the camp, who called it an ugly act of asymmetrical warfare that they killed themselves. And yet the Justice Department appears to have closed the books on these three cases. One of them was the son of a Saudi police official who did his own investigation and came up with a lot of very serious questions. Yet this is another issue where the Obama administration is looking forward, not backward, and these appear to be murders that occurred. You were there at the time. Do you have any recollection of those events that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, you're correct. I was there at the time it happened. I mean, and, you know, as you know, I've certainly been exceptionally critical of Guantanamo and of the military commissions. And personally, if I thought there was anything to the murder theory, you know, I wouldn't hesitate to say so. And I've got a great deal of respect for Scott Horton and the coverage he's provided over the years. But my personal belief, and I'm, you know, fairly convinced that these truly were suicides. And I can give you a couple of reasons real quickly why I believe that. First off, the three men, you know, when I heard there were three deaths, there were several names that came to mind. You know, kind of the major players and some of the ones that have been hunger strikers and feces throwers and troublemakers. The three people that died, I'd never heard of. I mean, they were inconsequential people that I didn't even know the names. At the time this happened was in June of 2006. If you recall, that was right about the time that the Hamdan decision was coming out of the Supreme Court. So we thought that the military commissions process was going to get the green light to go. So we were gearing up, anxious to get started with the trial. So, and you also had, that was right about the time that we had briefed the National Security Council and got President Bush's approval to transfer the high-value detainees, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Nashiri and those guys, from the CIA to Guantanamo. So there was an awful lot of reason for the leadership to be on their good behavior at Guantanamo and not want to draw attention to it, rather than killing three no-name detainees for sport. You know, as you know, one of the three had been cleared for release and was due to go home shortly, but there's just no rational explanation for why those three people would have been picked for murder. And particularly, I mean, I know the cell block they were on, where, you know, I've been through it a number of times myself, and I can't say that it's impossible, but the likelihood of getting three people out of the cell block, kill them, and then bring their bodies back in without the detainees around them just pitching a fit is hard to imagine. So
And what about the testimony that Horton has gathered from guards who saw them removed from camp and come back the next morning dead?
Again, it would take a massive... I mean, first, you'd have to have the guards to get them out of the cells. Then you'd have to have guards that have access to the transport vans that they use to move the detainees around. Then you'd have to have the guards to get them out of the gate of Camp Delta. Then you'd have to have the CIA folks that ran the other sites you're referring to let them in. I mean, it would take a massive conspiracy to put together this plot to murder three people that were... you know, just weren't significant players.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, I can't say it's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But if I, you know, if I had to place a bet, I firmly believe that it was three suicides and not three murders.
And do you think it's been adequately investigated?
Now, that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And again, I think, you know, we owe we owe our own citizens, we owe the world a duty of transparency. Again, I don't think we can just look forward. We got to look back. And so I think there certainly should be a thorough investigation. It ought to be public. But as I said, you know, I was there at the time. I wasn't involved. I mean, my job was, you know, preparing cases for prosecution in the military commission, so I didn't have a direct role in, you know, in the aftermath of the three deaths. But it's certainly my belief that, you know, if there was a story there, as I said, I haven't been bashful about being critical of Guantanamo.
No, you haven't.
Or the military commissions or torture or any other issue. And, you know, if I thought there was something to it, I'd say so. But I just honestly don't believe there was.
All right. I respect your point of view, and I must acknowledge you were there and I wasn't, much closer to the situation. And so I appreciate having your perspective on that. Let me close, Colonel, by circling back to our early comments about the missing testicles of the president. And what did transpire? Because there are a lot of theories. People think that one world government, the Bilderbergers, got to him. There are some people who feel that when he was briefed after the election, they basically took him into the dark side from which no one can return. But here is a little more plausible theory. In the May issue of Harper's Magazine, Jonathan Stevenson, who was then a professor of strategic studies at the Naval War College, wrote a piece that was pretty courageous for a guy who's in the system, where he asked the question, has the president lost control of his generals? And he talks about McChrystal challenging him through Rolling Stone magazine and some of the other efforts up to and including General Petraeus, who have really faced down this president and, in general, gotten him to do their bidding. And Stevenson, who I recently emailed to invite back on the program, told me that just a few weeks ago, he joined the National Security Council as an expert on the Middle East. I'm heartened by that because, based on his previous expression, he might bring some new think into the stale groupthink of the Obama foreign policy team. Here's a quote from Stevenson. Our generals are getting bolder. We've lost our ability to recognize when they're overstepping their constitutional powers. This is not the threat of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower spoke about. This is new. The military isn't just trying to ramp up spending. It's interjecting its voice into the sphere of statecraft as it never has before. How do you respond to Mr. Stevenson's comments?
Well, I think it's a... You know, as you said, I think courageous on his part, given his role at the time that he wrote it, and encouraging, as you said. I mean, there are, you know, again, I hate to paint with too broad a brush, because there are some very good people in the Obama administration that I know personally that that I was encouraged to see get appointed to the offices that they're in. On the other hand, I've seen some, like Guantanamo, for instance. You know, I think the reason for that order that President Obama signed on day one was White House counsel Greg Craig, who, as you know, resigned about a year later. And I think largely out of frustration that the administration was not following through. So there are some good people in the administration that I think have their heart in the right place. I think, you know, again, it's interesting. I mean, we didn't have the, in World War II, you didn't have, you know, Twitter and the internet and all the things that we do now, and certainly interacting with the media, and, you know, certainly some of the senior military leadership has not been particularly adept at doing that. And certainly, you know, as you saw, General Petraeus kind of stepped on it by doing that. But in my experience was, it was the uniform side was unanimously behind the Geneva Conventions and against torture, and at least in, you know, my little realm of the world, they were trying to do it right. And it was the political side that, you know, that stared them down and backed them off.
Well, and let's be fair about that, because Harry Reid, the Democratic leader of the Senate, is one of the main obstacles to closing Guantanamo. He's made it very clear, and it doesn't appear to be pure pandering on his part. He had a tough election last year, but he's been fairly consistent in what I consider to be a really dumb position. And then we've got Leon Panetta. I knew Leon as a congressman and as a before. I really haven't been in touch with him very closely since he went to the Clinton White House. But I recall vividly his confirmation hearing as CIA director when he was brushed back by Senator Kit Bond of Missouri because Panetta had said that he opposes torture and waterboarding in particular. And Bond basically said, well, how do you know that? And Panetta said, well, I based it on news accounts. And Panetta had to backpedal from his statements. And to me, that was a pivot point, at least in public perception, of how Panetta basically was sworn into the national security establishment.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, again, you know, we started out talking about Guantanamo. Closing Guantanamo, I think, would be a huge first step on the road to redemption. But simply closing it and moving it, you know, moving the detainees to Illinois or someplace else, all you've done is created a new Guantanamo. So in addition to closing it, it's resolving the, you know, the legal issues of avoiding another Guantanamo that we need to address. So,
well, and this same team has thousands of people stashed at the new prison at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. We know that not all of those people were detained in Afghanistan. Some of them were imported to do time there. And the Obama administration will not even release a list of those being held to the International Red Cross.
I agree. Yeah, you're right. And the vast majority of the American public care less. You rarely hear anything, any discussion about Bagram. I mean, Guantanamo at least gets a little bit of attention, but it's a small fraction of the number of detainees that are being the U.S. is involved in holding around the world.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Colonel, I really appreciate you joining me. You've been very generous with your time here today. Is there anything you would like to say to my listeners as we wrap up?
I would just encourage them to stay engaged and don't give up the fight. You know, America is an exceptional country, but you know, we're not an exception. The rules apply to us just like they do everybody else, and we've got to live up to them. So keep fighting the fight.
Air Force Colonel Morris Davis, thank you for the fight, and I hope you'll continue because you're a little more effective than I am.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Nice to talk with you, sir. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. I'll be much obliged.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.